Okay, so let's unpack this. When you think of Scotland, you probably picture towering castles, dramatic battles, maybe the whole romance of tartan and kilts.
Right.
Today, we are diving deep into the history of that dynamic northern nation, drawing on Rab Houston's sweeping, incredibly nuanced history, simply titled Scotland.
And we're going to take that romanticized postcard image and, replace it with something far more complex.
More resilient, and frankly, a lot more compelling.
That's really our mission for you today. We are trying to cut through the folklore, the idea that Scottish history is just a simple, linear narrative of kings and military struggles.
Yeah, the kings and battles version of history.
Exactly. We want to grasp the truly complex and dynamic nature of Scottish identity over two millennia. This deep dive isn't just about chronicling events. It's about gaining a sophisticated, kind of bottom-up understanding of a small country that managed to leave a disproportionately massive mark on the world.
And the relevance, I mean, it couldn't be higher. If you're following global news, Scotland's continuing place in the world, the question of independence, its political relationship with the UK, these are constant headlines.
Yeah.
You simply cannot understand the current debates or what motivates modern Scottish politics without tracing these deep historical roots.
It's the essential context. You really need to know which parts of the national story are myth, which parts are institutional grit, and which parts are rooted in, well, profound economic disaster.
So let's introduce the expert guide taking us through this monumental task. That's Rab Houston, professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews, holding a PhD from Cambridge.
So he's certainly qualified.
Absolutely. But what makes his take on it all truly distinctive?
His credentials are top tier, for sure, but his approach is the key. Houston is, first and foremost, a distinguished social and economic historian. Many histories focus on the actions of the political elite, the monarchs, the generals.
History read only from the top down.
Exactly. But that leaves out 90% of the population, doesn't it?
It really does.
So Houston gives us this crucial bottom-up view. He prioritizes the lived experiences of ordinary Scots, the farmers, the village artisans, the merchants in the developing towns.
So instead of just court records?
Right. He synthesizes vast amounts of demographic data, literacy rates, and cultural evidence to show us how society actually functioned.
That shift in focus is why this source is so powerful for our deep dive. He's moving past the narrative of William Wallace, the hero, and showing us the gritty details of what life was like for the average person.
And how that shaped the nation's cultural survival.
And he covers the full scope, too.
He does. The book is scholarly yet remarkably accessible, chronicling Scottish history from its earliest geological and human origins, the Picts and Celts, all the way up to the reestablishment of the Scottish Parliament in the late 20th and early 21st century.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting, because this is the core insight. Houston argues that Scottish history is not a simple heroic struggle against the southern neighbor.
No, it's much more complicated than that. He says identity has been a dynamic force, shaped just as profoundly by internal divisions.
That enduring Highland-Lowland rift.
Exactly. That and intense religious fervor and deep European connections.
It's a compelling argument because it forces you to look inward.
It does. The key to Scotland's endurance, even after losing political independence in 1707, wasn't military might. It was the strength of its unique civil institutions.
And we're talking specifically about the church, right? The Kirk.
The Kirk, yes, but also the distinct Scottish legal system and its groundbreaking educational framework.
So the state disappears politically, but the cultural operating system remains intact.
That's a great way to put it,
Exactly.
exactly. These institutions acted as the true resilient guardians of Scottish culture and identity, allowing the national character to not just survive, but to profoundly flourish.
Which we'll get to with the Enlightenment.
Right. And Houston's overall purpose is clear. He wants to provide the foundational context you need to understand current political debates without taking a side on the question of independence itself.
That's the perfect lens. So let's start the chronological journey. The formation of the kingdom up to about 1560, Houston immediately dispels the romantic myth of a unified Celtic people who just, decided to form a nation.
Absolutely. The creation of Scotland, or Elba, was a long, messy, and contingent process of amalgamation. You had the Picts in the north, the Scoti moving in from Ireland.
The Angles pushing up from the south, the Britons in the west.
It was a centuries-long negotiation to fuse these disparate groups into a coherent political entity.
And a major difference from England was the Roman footprint, wasn't it? The Roman presence was always peripheral in Scotland.
Very much so. It was marked by Hadrian's and the Antonine Walls.
Yeah.
It was a hostile frontier, not a place that saw the deep cultural transformation and civic infrastructure that characterized Roman Britain further south.
And that difference matters profoundly to later cultural development.
It really does. Then we hit the flashpoint of the Wars of Independence. Houston analyzes these not just as military struggles, though they were that, but as the crucible where national political consciousness was truly forged.
You mentioned the Declaration of Arbroath in 1320, that famous letter to the Pope. How did that document go beyond simply declaring who was king?
Well, it's one of the most remarkable medieval political statements. It asserted the idea of a contractual monarchy.
Meaning what exactly?
The signers stated explicitly that if the King Robert the Bruce, at the time, failed to protect the nation's independence, the community of the realm had the right to choose another king.
Wait, that is a truly revolutionary idea for 1320. It wasn't just loyalty to a divine ruler.
No, it asserted that the king served the will and consent of the people. That must have defined the relationship between ruler and ruled in Scotland for centuries afterward.
It did. It set the stage for a more independent, questioning political culture, which brings us to the next seismic shift, the godly Commonwealth period, starting around 1560.
And Houston views the Protestant Reformation, led by John Knox, as the most profound cultural revolution in Scottish history.
That's a strong claim. More profound than the Wars of Independence.
Because the Reformation remade the daily lives and the institutional scaffolding of the nation, the Presbyterian Church, or the Kirk, it created this parallel power structure that penetrated society so deeply.
You mentioned the Kirk sessions. What did they actually do on a day-to-day basis?
They essentially acted as local moral courts and parish-level governments.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just dealing with, you know, complex theology. They were policing petty crimes, enforcing sexual morality, mediating family disputes, punishing Sabbath breaking.
Wow, so it was a social microscope.
A very powerful one, yeah.
Yeah.
It enforced this stringent, unified moral code that bound communities together.
And the greatest long-term impact of that intense religious fervor was on education, correct?
Yes. The focus on Bible literacy was the absolute game changer. The Kirk insisted that every individual must be able to read the scriptures, which led to the establishment of a school in every parish.
Every single parish?
Everyone. This made Scotland one of Europe's most intensely literate societies. It democratized intellectual life and really fueled the confidence of the later Enlightenment.
So we have this strong institutional and intellectual infrastructure. What finally forced the political elite to give up their state? That brings us to the catalysts for the 1707 political union.
Right. The union of the crowns in 1603 was important, but the true hammer blow was economic. The disastrous failure of the Darien scheme.
The Darien scheme. It was a national trauma that is almost impossible to overstate, isn't it?
It was. It was this wildly ambitious plan to establish a Scottish trading colony on the Isthmus of Panama. The Scots poured nearly all their available national capital, up to a quarter of all liquid wealth in Scotland, into this one venture.
And it failed completely.
Utterly, due to disease, mismanagement, and critical interference from English political and trading interests.
So a catastrophic failure that bankrupted the Scottish elite.
And when the negotiations for the Act of Union came around shortly after, the ruling class was just desperate. They weren't coming from a position of strength or patriotic sacrifice. They were driven by a profound need for economic security.
To recoup their losses.
Exactly.
So that reframes the 1707 Act of Union. It's not a national betrayal, though many at the time saw it that way.
Right. It was more a calculated, if painful, bargain struck by a pragmatic elite who chose economic opportunity over a very precarious political independence.
That is Houston's essential nuance.
It is. But the brilliance of the negotiation was that the union preserved the Kirk, the distinct legal system, and the universities.
And that preservation is the key to the great paradox that follows. The Golden Age, the Scottish Enlightenment, occurred after political independence was lost. How does that happen?
Because the institutions that fostered free thought remained. Figures like Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations and basically invented modern economics, and David Hume, who transformed philosophy, they operated within that resilient Scottish ecosystem.
They proved that culture, law, and intellect don't need a parliament to flourish.
It's the ultimate lesson in the power of civil society. And culturally, the Scots quickly became enthusiastic, globally focused participants in the British Empire.
As soldiers, engineers, administrators, doctors.
They found purpose and prosperity on a global stage. But we can't overlook the brutality that accompanied this transition, specifically the systematic suppression of the old order, like the Jacobite risings, and the aggressive destruction of the Highland clan system.
Which brings us to the 19th century, when Scotland enters its industrial zenith. It became the workshop of the empire, known worldwide for shipbuilding and heavy industry.
Immense national wealth was generated, but Houston highlights the devastating social cost of this rapid modernization.
He details the massive social stratification, appalling overcrowding in cities like Glasgow.
And, crucially, the acceleration of the Highland clearances. This was not some noble national tragedy. It was brutal systemic displacement. Landowners, seeking greater profits from large-scale sheep farming, violently evicted thousands of tenant farmers.
It sounds like internal colonization.
It was exactly that. Homes were burned, tenants were forced onto crowded ships for mass emigration to Canada, the U.S., Australia. It created a deep, enduring, painful rift between the industrialized lowlands and the depopulated highlands that persist even today.
And finally, the modern era. That incredible industrial machine went into a long, painful decline after World War I and collapsed completely after 1945.
And that economic depression, that feeling of a vacuum, according to Houston, is the engine of modern Scottish politics.
He makes a direct link.
A critical one. The subsequent economic void, the collapse of Clydeside shipbuilding, the loss of heavy industry jobs, that was the key driver for modern political nationalism. The rise of the SNP and the focus on resources like North Sea oil were less about medieval grievances and more about finding a new national economic purpose in a post-imperial world.
That comprehensive timeline gives us such a solid foundation. Let's distill the major themes. The first has to be the fluidity and resilience of Scottish identity.
That's fundamental. Identity has been constantly reinvented. It moved from dynastic loyalty to political consciousness, then religious unity, and finally, civic pride.
So it's not a zero-sum game.
Not at all. It teaches you that identity is layered and adaptive. You can be Scottish, British, and potentially European all at once.
The second massive theme is the centrality of civil institutions.
Yes. The preservation of the legal system, the Kirk, and the universities after 1707 was the critical mechanism for cultural survival. The takeaway is that a robust civil society can be the most potent guardian of a culture, even when the political state is subsumed.
And we keep coming back to that persistent internal divide, Highlands versus Lowlands.
Scotland has never been monolithic. The clearances were internal colonization that created a huge economic and emotional rift. It's a reminder that national narratives often mask significant, painful internal conflicts.
And finally, the complex, ambiguous relationship with England.
It's defined by intense conflict, like the Wars of Independence, but also deep, successful collaboration in building the empire. It teaches us that the most important external relationships are rarely simple rivalries. They are complex negotiations of power, identity, and mutual economic interest.
Houston gives us some truly powerful key ideas that really encapsulate this nuanced view.
Yeah, they move beyond the slogans.
The first one is that we must understand the 1707 Act of Union less as a national betrayal and more as a calculated, if painful, bargain struck by a desperate, pragmatic elite.
That changes the whole moral framework of the history. Post-Darien, the elite chose economic opportunity over a precarious independence. You have to prioritize economic reality over patriotic sentiment to really get it.
And building on that, he highlights the preservation of its unique legal, religious, and educational institutions after 1707 as the critical factor that allowed Scotland to flourish.
It's the crucial insight. These non-political bodies, the law, the Kirk, the universities, fostered the intellectual confidence that gave rise to Adam Smith and David Hume. They were the engine of Scotland's continued cultural distinction.
And finally, he states that the modern call for independence is not born of ancient grievance alone.
No, it's rooted in the 20th century experience of deindustrialization and the search for a new national purpose in a post-imperial world.
That connects current political movements directly to the trauma of industrial collapse. It's a much clearer lens than looking back 600 years.
Absolutely. It's the post-1945 economic vacuum that drove the political reawakening.
This book offers amazing frameworks for analyzing events far beyond Scotland's borders, giving you real-life applications for this knowledge. For instance, understanding global identity issues.
Right. Scotland's layered case, being Scottish, British, potentially European, is a perfect model for analyzing other regions with complex claims to autonomy.
Like Quebec in Canada or Catalonia in Spain.
Exactly. Houston's work shows how national identity can be successfully layered without being mutually exclusive.
And the economic adaptation lessons are huge.
They are. Scotland's transition from an industrial core to a post-industrial society offers direct frameworks for understanding how communities worldwide must respond to the decline of traditional industries.
The challenges of globalization.
Right. Ultimately, for you, the listener, this knowledge provides the essential long-term context you need for informed discourse. It allows you to move past simplistic headlines and understand the deep historical, cultural, and economic factors driving contemporary politics.
It teaches you to ask the right questions.
The final insight Houston leaves us with is that a nation is ultimately defined by more than its government or its borders. It is a product of its institutions, its culture, and the shared consciousness of its people. He replaces the kilts and castles of romanticism with rigorous, essential analysis.
And that profound thought on the power of non-political institutions is a perfect place to pause. Scotland's history is one of remarkable resilience and constant negotiation between faith and reason, and between political independence and deep economic integration.
It's a story of how a small nation, through sheer institutional and intellectual grit, made a disproportionately large mark on the world.
And why its future is still one of the most compelling political dramas of our time. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.